opportunity we'll have after that, so we'll talk about Pesach now, because there is an idea that 30 days before something happens in the mystical world, so the force of that thing already applies in the world. We have that actually as a halacha, that 30 days before Yom Tov, we start discussing the laws and customs, and we start preparing ourselves for that thing. It has a source in the Gemara, it has a mystical source also, which is that, what can I tell you, it says Monday night is supposed to be mystical night. It says that the person's aura, you know, the mystical light that surrounds the body, it undergoes certain changes 30 days before certain things occur. So there's a whole mystical idea that once you enter the phase of 30 days before something, that thing starts to shine in the spiritual world. And after Purim, what happens to start shining, if you like, is Pesach. And there's a very deep and mystical connection between the two. And let's try and feel out. Is there no room for those people? They can't fit inside. Maybe you can move just a bit closer. Sorry. Let's try and explore together a very deep idea that comes out of the whole concept of preparing for Pesach. Now, what we want to take out of this practically, mystically and intellectually, so there's a wonderful idea that's over here. But practically, if you're given more to the practical side and you want to know, personality-wise, what you can do with this, so if you stay with me and you understand the subject, then you'll see that there's a wonderful insight into the mechanism of what makes the personality, the engine that drives your own inner personality, your own being, and that's at the core of what you are. If you take this idea seriously and you understand it well, so any time when your life seems difficult, you'll be able to recall this idea, and it's almost guaranteed to inject a tremendous energy into your life. Try and understand together. There's a limit to what we can explore in terms of the mystical, but let's try and feel out how far this idea goes to the level that we can, and then we can try and apply it in every area of our own personalities also, relationships. You'll see it applies to everything. First of all, you have to be sensitive to the fact that Pesach is a very special time. Every time is special, but there's a specialness to Pesach of its own that has its own flavor. You'll see it in many different ways. First of all, you'll see Jewish families that don't keep anything, but they take Pesach very seriously. There are many South African Jewish families where the family has moved well away from Jewish observance, but Pesach they take very seriously. People who eat unkosher food, but they wouldn't eat bread on Pesach. People who don't keep Shabbos at all, but they search the house for every last crumb, almost fanatical way. Where did this power, I'm not saying you should do it in a fanatical way, you shouldn't. You should remember that you're looking for chometz, not for dirt. And it's not a time for the lady of the house to start scratching out the cracks between the parquet floorboards. That's not what it's designed for. Not an excuse for spring cleaning. It's a mystical idea. Usually what happens is by the time the Pesach Seder arrives, and you're all hyped up for Pesach, after the first two words, the lady of the house is absolutely asleep on the table, because he's so exhausted that the rest of the thing becomes meaningless, and that's not what it should be. It's supposed to be a most amazing inspiration that should last through the year. The mystics say that you can achieve a mysterious level, a mystical level on Pesach that you can't any other time. You are justified in leaping to a level that you're actually not capable of on Pesach. You can leap up to a level spiritually above you in terms of relationships, in terms of your own physical environment. There are many things you can do that you can take a hold of on Pesach that are absolutely impossible. But it's a time of open miracles, and every year has that force. But you have to know how to ride that wave. Of course, you've got to pay for it afterwards. After you've leapt up to that level, you have to stay on that level. That means very hard work later to stay at that level. Then you have to put in the effort. But you can leap to the level that you could, might have taken you years and years to build. Bit by bit, you can do it in one go on Pesach. And a very worthwhile understanding how this works. There's a sense of extremism, of intensity about Pesach. You see it coming out in the kind of cleaning, the observance of Pesach that we stay with, that people who don't even have a sensitivity anymore to what kosher food is. Mystical writings say that if you eat things that are unkosher, it desensitizes your heart. Not just that it's a sin, let alone the transgression element. But even if you don't know it's a transgression, let alone the fact that you're doing what you shouldn't. But there's a reality to unkosher food, certain kinds, that makes what's called an uncircumcised heart. It means that there's a covering, a dull insensitivity around your own spiritual being. That's what happens. And there are people who are insensitive to that, but they couldn't bring themselves to eat a crumb on Pesach. It's a remarkable thing that we have to understand. You see that this quality of the Jewish people is taken to extremes. There's a story, I think it's about Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, if I'm not mistaken, one of the great Hasidic leaders, who wanted to prove this point about the Jewish people. And he demonstrated it once to someone who asked him, what is the level of Jewish people's intensity and integrity? How can we actually see? You tell me that these are great people, that they stay with devotion to their laws. They go to extremes for it. How do we see it? So he demonstrated it to his friend, whoever was asking the question, I don't remember who it was, in the following way. He called in his shamus, and he said to him, do me a favor, go out into the community and bring me a little tobacco. And it was in a generation when tobacco was contraband, it was illegal. There was no way you could procure any. Anybody who owned any tobacco, there were tremendous fines and even a death sentence by the Polish, by the government of that time. So he said to Shabbos, do me a favor, he's asking for forbidden contraband, which was in the level of the most forbidden, like drugs would be, I don't know what it would be. It was a death sentence for anybody who had any. The Shabbos went out, and in a few minutes he was back with as much tobacco as he wanted. He said he went around and he said that the Rebbe had asked for some tobacco, and all the Jews in town had offered to get him as much as it wasn't a problem. They could procure as much right on the spot, no problem, free of charge. Tobacco was free to be had. Then he sent his shamus out. It was Erev Pesach. He asked him to come back with a beer. The shamus went out, and after a long time he came back and he said he couldn't find a beer in town. Not even that the Rebbe had asked for it personally. There wasn't a Jew. There wasn't a Jew in all the length and breadth of everywhere he could get to that had a crumb of chometz in the house for no price in the world. So he said, look at those, look at that people. That when it comes to tobacco, on which there's a death sentence, right, you name it, you can have the quantity you want immediately. But when it comes to a crumb of chometz, it's only Hashem said. This decree on tobacco is made by the king, some Polish king who rules the country. And there it's not a problem. Jews don't even take it seriously. But when it comes to a crumb of chometz, well, it's no punishment at all that you can understand in this world. But because a mystical abstract force tells us not to do that, for no price in the world could he procure a crumb of chometz. A remarkable quality of the Jewish people. We have to understand, why is it such an extreme idea? That's the problem. Why is it that in all aspects of Judaism we have limits? We have a minimal level that you have to exceed in order to enter the category. Right below that level, I don't know if you're aware of that, you should know that this is a very unusual aspect of Jewish understanding and belief, is that for non-Jews, the system that non-Jews have a certain set of laws they have to live by according to the Torah. The unique feature of those laws, it happens that there are only seven of them, but the unusual feature about those seven is that they're much more strict and severe than ours are for us. I don't know if you're aware of that. The punishments for non-Jews are much more severe than ours are, and what I want to focus on now is that the tolerances are much closer. If a non-Jew doesn't keep, if he breaks one of his seven laws, so it doesn't matter by how much he breaks it, no matter how infinitesimally, he's guilty in the same sense as if he'd broken it by a larger margin. An amazing thing. Whereas a Jew, if he breaks one of his laws, has to do it by enough of a margin to be considered that he's actually done it. For example, a person who eats on Yom Kippur. So eating on Yom Kippur, the Torah only forbids, rabbinically we forbid it at any level, but the Torah only forbids it if you eat more than a certain amount. If you have a tiny amount, medically we use this, patients who can't fast. So if they're able to, we have them eat very small amounts at a time, because the Torah never prohibited less than a certain amount. It prohibited only a satisfying amount. Of course, we don't do this. But from a Torah point of view, that's it. For a person to break Shabbos, you have to do enough of the action to steal. Do you know that for a Jew to be held actionable, taken to court for stealing, you have to steal more than a certain amount, which is a pruta, 10 cents, 20 cents, it's a small amount. But nevertheless, less than that is not actionable in Jewish law. It's not considered significant. You're not allowed to do it, make no mistake. One may not do it, but it's not actionable. Whereas in the non-Jewish system, no amount is permitted. It's a remarkable thing. But the unusual feature of Pesach is that there's no limit. One crumb, even the amount of chometz that's absorbed into the sides of a pot, that's completely undetectable, has the most significant damaging effect on the neshama. And the damage that it has is not just that it desensitizes you, it kills you. Chometz, the punishment for eating chometz on Pesach is koras. Koras means excision of the neshama. It means it's a spiritual death. I mean, you have to do it knowingly to get that degree of consequence. But nevertheless, that's the potential that it has. If you eat dry food, even knowingly, it doesn't have that level of consequence for the neshama. But if you eat one crumb of bread on Pesach, in the right way, the wrong way, knowing what you're doing. So it has that tremendous potential for spiritual death. Why is it like that? And why is it that no amount makes a difference, the tiniest amount? Why is it? That's what we have to try and understand. Now, you'll see that the understanding of this goes to the root of what the world is, what a Jew is, what our own personalities are. It's possibly the most, if you're not inspired by this, nothing's going to inspire you. Right? If this isn't an inspiring idea, but it's at the root of everything that you are, I don't think you should come again. The question is like this. Let's approach it this way. There's a mystical, certain great mystical work that approaches the problem this way. That we're going to take a wonderful tour now through some of the deepest mystical areas. There's a very well-known mystical work which puts the problem as follows. There's a statement. Mr. Shem, during Pesach we'll have time to talk about other aspects of this which are fascinating also. Let's follow one theme through now. There is a statement by the mystics. There's a statement in Chazal that says that the Jews in Egypt, before they were redeemed at Pesach time, were on the 49th level of impurity. Right? They were on the lowest rung. You know, there are only 49 rungs. 7 times 7. The 50th means completely outside the system. The 50th isn't 50. It just means outside completely. That means fallen out completely. Right? Out of all spiritual existence. They were on the 49th level of spiritual death, impurity. Understand what this means, but that's what happened. And they were saved, right? They were saved because they were saved instantaneously, they were saved fast. They had to go out of Egypt rapidly, right? Not even time for the bread to bake, as you remember. Because 1 minute longer in Egypt would have killed them. That means 1 minute longer, 1 hour longer, 1 day, whatever, would have sunk them into the 50th level and that would have been everything lost. That's why they had to go out in a rush. They were at the 49th level. By the way, as we're talking, you should try and remember these ideas in terms of these things. We have to do a difficult job this evening, and that is understand the root of the idea in the spiritual world and bring it down into very, very practical. Normally what we talk about on Monday nights, we try to understand the root of a thing and then see its source in the personality. But on Pesach, you have to actually bring it out into the practical. It's a remarkable thing. There are many families where they actually act these things out at the Seder for the children. It's a time to inspire children with the ability that they can reach greatness. And if there's one time that you can inspire a child so that he can feel that he can actually grow up to be larger than life and actually achieve something and actually bring out his potential in the world, Pesach is the time that you have to do that. And that's why the Seder, there are many people who give the Seder specifically to the children. In fact, you should make an effort to do that. I'm not going to talk now about the practical details, but you should make an effort to go fast through the Seder so that you can get to the meal while the children are still awake. They should enjoy themselves. They should hear the whole story. If you want to talk your own mystical depths and so forth, you can talk till 2 in the morning after the children have collapsed, after the meal. But while the children are still awake, the ones for whom the whole thing is, that tremendous transmission of Jewish values, which is what the inspiration of Pesach is, so that the children should be awake for, and therefore they should be meaningful to them. One shouldn't prepare all sorts of deep things to say at the Seder where the children won't understand. And I know families where, when the father tells the child, the Hasidic families that do this, and some non-Hasidic families, when the father tells the child that they went out of Egypt, we went out of Egypt in a hurry and the bread didn't have time, he puts the matzah in a pillowcase and puts it over his back like a sack and he walks around the room like a slave who's carrying a load and is going to escape. Right? And it makes a tremendous impression on a child. In many families, the father wears a kittel, the white robes, and he actually marches around, he shows what it was like to labor as a slave, and then he shows what it was like to carry the matzahs and to rush out while before they were. It makes a tremendous impression on a child. They have to try and translate it into those practical things. Trying to drive something very deep into the personality of the family. Now, let's understand. The 49th level of impurity was such that 1 minute longer, they would have been lost. And the story of Pesach is a story of rushing. They had a rush out before they descended into that 50th level. And we're going to see that the whole idea of Pesach is speed. It's a rush. It's trying to beat the deadline. To understand what that means in the personality. Of course, that's what life is. That's what life is in the broader sense. There's a very heavy deadline. And you've got to get everything done by that time. Let's understand it in its depth. Now, the question that bothers this particular mystical thinker is as follows. How is it possible to say, think about it carefully, I think we mentioned various aspects of this last year, 2 years ago, I don't remember. How is it possible to say that 1 minute longer would have destroyed them? Stay with me now. What we are saying is that at that hour of midnight when the Jews left Egypt, Had they been left any longer, they would have disappeared. They would have assimilated, they would have disappeared as Jews, they would have descended into the world of impurity. How is it possible to say that when you think about what was happening at that time? Understand carefully. If you tell me that one more minute of slavery would have destroyed them, I would understand. When the plagues, before the plagues had begun, before Egypt, before Hashem revealed himself to the Egyptians, right, let's say 10 months or a year, whenever the plagues began, some months before, the Jews were enslaved. If you tell me that they reached such a position of being broken in their slavery, that one more minute would have destroyed them, I would understand that. By the way, we know the women weren't broken. I know, you're aware of that. The men were broken by the slavery. The women retained enough power to save the Jewish people. We'll have to talk about that some other time also, but it should be known. It always was the women who saved us. But the men, anyway, had reached the position of being broken, not by the Egyptian torture. And another minute of that would have broken them. That I could understand. But to tell me that after Hashem had revealed himself, and after the plagues had all become apparent in Egypt, and it was a moment of intensity, right? At that moment when Hashem was going through Egypt, revealing himself, it says no angel, not even a messenger, not even a spiritual emanation from him, but he himself, whatever that means, was going through Egypt killing the firstborn. What do you mean to tell me that one more minute of that would have killed them? Do you hear how crazy it is? That was the greatest moment they ever experienced. One more minute of that would have been ecstatic. It was a moment where they were very, very close to Hashem. They'd come to a level of spiritual depth, of mystical, of emunah, faith, understanding, that was so deep that it was almost a perfect connection with Hashem. It was almost a permanent connection with Him. How can the mystics say, you follow, how can Chazal say that had they been left for one more minute in Egypt, they would have been lost? You hear the problem? It's a tremendous problem. You know that those Jews were, not only had they reached that level, but anyone who didn't merit to be at that level had died already. You know that 4/5 of the Jews died in Egypt during the plague of darkness. 4/5 of the Jews weren't on a level that they were able to experience such a revelation. They weren't on a level that they were prepared to leave the slavery and go out into a desert, following Hashem, whom they'd never really assimilated the idea of what it meant deeply enough. They felt that was a fate worse than remaining slaves in Egypt. At least they had security. At least they had what they knew in Egypt. And because they couldn't raise themselves to the level of that consciousness, 80% of the Jews died. The Chazal says they died during the darkness, so the Egyptians shouldn't see. Because the Egyptians would then say that it wasn't the miraculous plague against them, it affected Jews also. So Hashem did it in a hidden way that the Egyptians didn't know. But only 1 in 5 of us merited to reach the level that we could go out of Egypt. That's a frightening thought. There are those who say that we might, unfortunately, have to go through the same thing again. It's only those who will be able to lift themselves to being able to experience what's happening to them. I hope it's not true. So those people with the cream, they were those who had already raised themselves to the level, and they were witnessing this experience, and they'd witnessed 10 plagues that were completely miraculous. Amazing miracles had happened. And Hashem had revealed himself completely. And not only that, but you have to understand that the 10 plagues were a revelation of the greatest depth of the creation. To understand this idea, the Gaon of Vilna says, a remarkable idea, the Gaon says that Egypt was so impure, they had so contaminated the human spirit, that they had managed to damage and to desensitize and to contaminate all 10 elements of creation. You know, the world is based on 10 mystical spheres of creation, each one embodied in a different command. It says that Hashem spoke 10 times, what's called Asara Ma'amoris, 10 sayings that created the world. The first one was Bereishis, the concept of a beginning. The second one was let there be light, okay, etc. Those sayings created the world, each of the 10 of them, and each one created a mystical sphere. Egypt had managed, Mitzrayim, had managed to contaminate all 10 levels of reality. In fact, the mystics call, the Chazal called Egypt Ervas Haaretz. It means the nakedness of the world. It means the real naked element where the world had been stripped to its most embarrassing core. That's how far they had deprived themselves in Egypt. It said that when the firstborn were killed in Egypt, lots and lots of people died who weren't firstborn. And many firstborn didn't die. That's what the people thought. Because they were so immoral that in every house somebody died and no one knew why. Because the woman had had a relationship with somebody else and what they thought was a firstborn wasn't. And somebody else was the product of a relationship with somebody else that was a firstborn and no one knew. So the whole thing was exposed. When the firstborn died, the real firstborn died. And not the people that the husband had thought was a firstborn or the wife had thought was a firstborn. And then the whole depravity was revealed in that way. But it was a tremendously depraved culture. So the plagues came. No accident that 10 of them came, in order each one to knock out an impurity in one of the 10 levels of reality that Egypt had contaminated. And of course, what was that done for? So they could reach the 10 commandments. Because each of the spheres had to be purified. You don't mind a bit of mystical talk, right? The 10 Atzeres HaDibros, the 10 commandments, had to be given to a world that had receptacles in all 10 spheres. And therefore, they all had to be cleansed. So Egypt had to have each of its 10 dimensions of negativity purified. And that's why the Gaon said the most wonderful thing, that what had happened in Egypt was like the pure kernel had been covered with layers, shells of impurity. In Hebrew, those layers are called, we don't even use the word because it gives them strength, but the kali, the kuf lamet, the shells, that peel, that are like peels of an onion, each one contaminating, each one holding in and blocking out the light from the spiritual core more and more. So the Gaon says, when you want to get to a spiritual core, how do you do it? When you peel an onion, you have to go from the outside in. Can't start inside. You have to peel the layers off from the outside. And therefore, the plagues in Egypt went in reverse order of the sayings that had created the world. Because the tenth saying that had created the world, so what that was at the core. So that therefore, the plagues had to go in reverse order. If you think about it, it's obvious. What was the tenth plague? Killing of the firstborn. What was the first of the sayings of creation? In the beginning. Because that's a new birth. Bereshit, that's a new birth. That's the firstborn, the world being born. What was this second last of the plagues? Darkness. What was the second of the sayings of creation? Let there be light. Right? In case you never noticed that in Chumash before. In case you never noticed it. And as you go through the ten, the Gaon works out how all of them are connected to the layers that had been built up of creation were now being peeled back to their purity. It's a remarkable thing. Right? They don't teach us this, right? They teach you all this. They teach you the outer layer. That's all they teach you. It's all they teach the children in Cheder. Instead of teaching them the panemius, the depth of it, that could allow them to connect to these things. Now, the Jews had witnessed that. That means they'd seen the layers peeled off one at a time. They'd seen the core exposed. When the core was exposed, the Bereshis level, the core of creation, Hashem himself appeared in Mitzrayim. Now, what sense does it make to say that one more hour of that, and they would have been lost in the depth of impurity? Do you follow? It doesn't begin to make sense. Are you with me? Let's try and understand this together. There are two answers to this problem, two understandings of it. One is a very mystical answer. The same source which I mentioned who asks the question, he answers in the following way. It's a very, very amazing idea, very deep mystical idea. I don't want to spend time on it. I'll just share it with you because it's something to think about. But there's another idea that we can possibly relate to more easily. But he answers as follows. Just want to mention it. He says this. When it says that the Jews would have been lost, it doesn't mean they would have been lost down. It means they would have been lost up. It doesn't mean they would have passed out of the bottom of reality. It means they would have spiraled out at the top. It doesn't mean that they would have passed out into assimilation and death. It means they would have so reached perfection by one more minute. One more minute of that voltage would have raised them, charged them to a level where they became one with the spiritual world. It doesn't mean, you follow, it doesn't mean they would have been lost by, and in a negative sense. That's a misunderstanding. It understands a very, very beautiful idea, this. Because it has to be true in both ways. But it means they would have been lost in the following sense. Understand carefully. If Hashem would have revealed himself any longer, the potency that the neshamas had reached, the voltage, the charge that the neshamas had assimilated by that time, would have got so high in the next minute that they would have absolutely, the neshamas would have flashed out of them to bond with that reality, which is what happened at Sinai. At Sinai, when the Jews stood at Sinai, when Hashem spoke, they all died. You know that. The Gemara says every Jew at Sinai died. Why? Because when Hashem appears in the world, the Neshama doesn't stay with you. The Neshama is very, very constrained and confined in a physical body, in a lowly physical body. So when Hashem appears and the Neshama sees that, it doesn't stay with you, it flies out to the source. And then Hashem had to resurrect them, he had to revive them. He sent certain forces, it says, and he resurrected them. And then the angels, whatever that means, they helped the Jews forward because it says that the neshamas flew to Hashem and the bodies were blasted back 12 miles. 12 mil, 12 kilometers, something like that. So the angels helped them forward to Sinai and they faced Hashem again and he spoke again and they all died again at the second commandment. So then, when the Jews were revived a second time, they said to Moshe Rabbeinu, that's enough. You hear the rest. the pain, difficult experience. You hear the rest and you tell us. But we didn't hear it from Hashem. We only heard the first two commandments directly. We didn't hear the rest of the Torah. That was transmitted to us by Moshe Rabbeinu. We only heard the first two. But when they came face to face with that reality, they couldn't stay in their bodies. If they'd remained at that level of Hashem appearing to them in Egypt anymore, they wouldn't have survived. Meaning they would have gone back, the world would have spiraled back to its unity of perfection, which is the final end result that Hashem wants from the world. That's what will happen finally, after the 7,000 years are over. They will spiral back, the 8th, 9th, and 10,000 years will go back to the mystical source. But, be that as it may, why could that not happen yet? Because they didn't deserve it. Because they spent 210 years in slavery, they hadn't worked on themselves to the level where they deserved such a revelation. Hashem did it because he couldn't leave them any longer in Egypt. Had the slavery lasted any longer, there was no chance that they would have been able to correct themselves and work on themselves to the level that they could do it correctly. A spiritual experience is only valid when you've built it yourself. We'll talk about this again in the future, Mr. Shem. But it doesn't mean anything when it's given to you. Anybody who knows anything about life knows that it's only what you work on and develop yourself that's actually meaningful. You might be given a handout in the beginning as an inspiration to get you going, but you don't appreciate that. It's when you build the thing yourself that it actually is meaningful. We'll have to talk about this separately. So Hashem saw that they, on the one hand, he couldn't leave them any longer in Egypt while they were slaves because they would really have been lost. On the other hand, he couldn't bring them to the final perfection because that's only real in the world when you do it yourself. So what could he do? So he saved them, but at the moment when they would have connected with the highest source, he immediately took them out of Egypt, right, and removed himself from revealing himself in that way and put them in the desert. The desert cools you off because the desert is a place of spiritual death. And in the desert, they had to work through many difficult experiences. And they had to go through the 7 days, and they were chased by the Egyptians, and then the Red Sea, and then 49 days of very hard work until they came to the Sinai experience. And then it was a meaningful experience. Then they could see Hashem and survive. Die and be resurrected and die, and then be survived as the Jewish people in the world. But they could only take that power, that voltage, after having worked on themselves through all 49 stages. The 49 stages that they hadn't worked on in Egypt, they had to work on those 49 stages in the desert. But to give it to them free, without having worked on, you follow, the voltage, the receptors, the, what do you call it, the resistors, the kalim, the tools, the vessels, couldn't hold that amount of voltage. The light would have shone for an instant and then burst. So they had to go through 49 days of building the kalim so the light could shine in the desert. And that's what it means, that one more minute, that you've got a beautiful answer to the question of how would one more minute in Egypt have caused them to be lost. But that's not the idea I want to emphasize this evening. There's an idea that we can take much more, that's a wonderful, beautiful, mystical idea, but there's an idea that we can, I heard from my Rebbe, that we can apply in the most amazing and intense way in our lives. That's as follows. The reason they had to be taken out in a hurry was as follows. The reason they couldn't stay any longer was as follows. It's a very difficult idea to grasp. Okay? Just to grasp its beginning is difficult, but it's worth trying. The reason they couldn't remain in Egypt any longer was not because they would have disappeared, not because they would have gone down spiritually, not because they would have entered a phase of impurity. That's not that. The problem with one more minute in Egypt would have been one more minute. Again, the problem with being there more time would have been time. The experience of being saved, the experience of being born as a Jewish people, that's when we were born. Right? We were taken out, we'd never been a people before. We'd arrived in Egypt as a family that grew to that number of people. We hadn't been united into a nation. Right? The experience of being born, it says that coming out of Egypt was like a shepherd putting his hand inside an animal. That's what it says. When an animal's giving birth and the shepherd puts his hand inside the animal to help it give birth, that's what Hashem did. He put himself inside Egypt, which is a place of impurity, even though he's of purity, and he brought us out as a newborn being. That's when we were born. That was our moment of birth. That's what it says. That moment of birth, had it expanded into a time zone that would have lasted for a finite period of time, we would have died. Understand this idea. What we're saying is this, that going out of Egypt had to be an instantaneous experience. It had to be a flash. We had to be born in a moment that approached infinity. Because if we were born in a moment that almost beat time, then we could be born as a people that can beat time. If we could be born, you follow, if Hashem could give birth to us, if he could drag us out of Egypt in such a hurry that no physical action had time to manifest in the world, then we would never be a physical people. But if he had taken us out of Egypt in a finite time, we would have been lost. Because we would have been a finite people. You know, we're an infinite people. We live after everybody else has died. We begin, just look at Jewish history. As we've often said, we begin where despair ends. We begin, our first father was Yitzchak, right? The first Jewish child was Isaac. And what was his beginning? Being shechted on a Mizbeach. The first experience he had, right? Before he could become a Jew, before he could get married, what was the last thing he did before he went and got married to Rivka and produced a Jewish family? Is that he bound himself, he was bound on an altar and had to be shechted by his father. And mystically it actually happened. Mystically. What does it mean? It means that Jewish life begins after you've passed into the next world. We begin in another dimension. You won't even begin here. That's what we are as a Jewish people. Now, look at Jewish history, nothing could be more obvious that we are people of another dimension. We don't live in this world, we live in the next world. But to do that, we had to be born in that way. Had we been born in a finite space of time, developed slowly like another nation, so we would have died slowly like other nations. We had to be born in a moment that's beyond time. And therefore, let's try and understand together what this means. When we discussed Emunah before, for those who were here end of last year, we discussed the fact that the highest level of the Das, of the mystical system, of mystical wisdom, the highest level is called Rotzin. Rotzin means the point in the mind where your desire becomes a desire. Nothing comes before that. Everything you do because of something motivating you to do that thing, right? What motivates that motivation? When you want something. So you go out and get the thing. Why do you go out and get the thing? Because you want it. Why do you want it? Because of some other reason. Why do you want that thing? Some other reason. But eventually you get back to a point where you want something because you want it. Is that right? Eventually there's something that motivates you for no reason. That is your base. That's who you are. That's who you are. We discussed this in detail many times. That's called Rotzon. That's why the word Ratzon in Hebrew, the root of it is Ratz, meaning the beginning of movement. Because that's everything moves out from there. And the word adds up to the same numerical value as Makor, which means the womb. Or source. Because that's the source of what you are. It also adds up to Hashem's name, because that's the source of everything. That's Ratzon. The first thing in the mind, right, is wrong. That moment is so infinitely thin, the beginning of anything touches on the infinite world. That's why you can't actually say why you want it. You just know that it is so. That is, for example, when you want something. Let's say you have an idea to do something. You have an idea, an inspiration to do something. And then what happens is after you have the inspiration, it starts to take shape in your mind. After it's taken shape, you go out and start doing it, and eventually you achieve it. What was the beginning of the process? A flash of inspiration. Where did it come from? When you have a good idea. Ever happened to you? You have a good idea. You have a flash of an idea. And then you start acting it out. Where did that flash come from? You never can trace it. Right? You never can trace where it came from. It came from a mystical world. It comes from a higher world. But it flashes in as a spark into your mind. That's the beginning of who you are. Completely undefinable. The scientific world doesn't even talk about it. But it happens from somewhere. Happens from nowhere. And it becomes what you are. It's the moment of the greatest ecstasy. Because in that flash of creation, everything's contained. After that, it's just a mechanical stretching out into space and time. In your mind, the details. And then in space and time, as it ponderously gets done. But in the instant of flash of creation, it's beyond. You can feel that. I can't prove it to you. You either feel it or you don't feel it. You either know these things in the mind or you don't. But when you generate a new idea, which is called the ultimate male experience, that's a moment of only lost a second, less than, and it's an ecstatic time. The female experience, the happiness comes in pain. The female experience is the one that builds reality, that's the happiness, but it costs a lot to do. It takes pain. Only a woman can do that. That's what it is. But the maleness of the experience, and that's of course, we'll have to talk about, see what we've got time for. That flash of inspiration, that's the creation of a thing. It's beyond time. It's completely in the mystical world. But it only is that way because it's beyond the physical world. And that is where everything's contained. And therefore, everything that ever happens in the world is just an expansion of that moment. When you have an idea or a desire, everything that you work on and bring out of the idea or the desire actually is just all the details that were contained in that instant. And actually, if you know yourself well, you're aware that when you flash a new idea, actually you're instantaneously aware, all at one and the same time, that you have the idea, that it's happy, that it's ecstatic, and you're actually aware of all the details all at once. Is that right? You can't begin to grab them. You can't. There isn't time for that. And then it starts to settle in your mind into its details. But actually, when it happens, you're conscious that it's all there. Is that right? Blank faces here and absolute smiles over here. Huh? There's a male experience. Just trying to make a lady feel good. But again, it's like that. That means in that moment you actually know that, which means like this. You can derive from your own inner being. If you're conscious of how you function, you will know that when something flashes in at the moment of conception, again, it's hard to talk about the details, it's a very intimate aspect of marriage where you learn this, but you have to figure it out for yourself. But in that moment of conception, everything's contained. That's the happiness of it, and that is an intense awareness that it's all there, which means this. It's a way of feeling that the totality of a thing is always contained in its beginning. The moment of birth, the moment of beginning, the moment of conception, whichever the beginning is that you're talking about, in that moment everything's contained. The rest of its life is just a bringing out of all its details, slowly and physically. But actually it must all be contained there. If it isn't in the genes, it can't come out in the body. It must be contained in the gene dimension before it can come out in the body. And therefore, everything that the Jewish people is, was contained in the second of their birth. Everything that the Jewish people is, everything that we are, must have been contained in that moment when we came out of Egypt. And everything that we are is a spiritual people. What we are is a people that's above the physical plane. And therefore, everything about our birth had to be compressed into the infinite dimension. That's why it had to happen so quickly. Let's try and understand this idea. Let's try and speak it out. Bring it down from the flesh into the expanded level and try and understand it. In the deepest mystical sources, says the following thing. I don't know anything about the mystical sources, what people tell me. If I did know, I wouldn't admit it anyway, because you're not allowed to, so you... So happens, I really don't know. But I know that it says this, okay? And there's one idea that I know it says, and that's as follows. That... The male dimension is a point. It means it has no dimension, right? It's the beginning, it's something from nothing. The female dimension is a circle. Then carefully. The female world is a circle, perfect circle. Again, there's elements of this that we can't talk about here. There are elements that we can. For example, when a man gets married, there's an ancient Jewish custom that the bride walks 7 times around the groom. Isha tesevev gever, a woman surrounds a man. What it means is that he takes her into his home, that's the symbol of the chuppah, but she tells him that she's giving him a place to be. That's why, which is what a woman is. That's how a man functions. A woman gives him a place to be. She's the place, and it's one of the reasons we give a ring, doesn't have to be a ring, one of the reasons we give a ring also, is that the symbol of what a woman is a circle. Now, a circle, again, you have to, if you're a violent feminist, you're going to have trouble with this, okay? You've got to try and hear this. I'm trying to understand this. We have spoken many times, if you've been here before, about the spiritual power of a woman. What we want to speak about here is the danger. The man has his own beauty and his own danger, as we've expressed many times. The woman has her beauty and potential and her danger. Again, let's not... I don't want to lose anybody. The beauty of being a woman is that you can make a thing real and give birth to it. A man can't do that. But the danger of being a woman is that you can freeze a thing solid. Are you with me? Do you understand? Oh, nobody understands. Good, they understand. Good. Fine. Like this. Since a woman, we're just using an example of a woman, this is actually, what we mean is the dimension of being female. But it's applied, right, in women. Many, not all women necessarily, but you'll find it usually expressed in women. What a woman has is the ability to make a thing real. But to make a thing real, you have to slow it down and make it expand it and build it. When a man contributes to the formation of a child, it takes the time and space content are minimal. It's just a set of genetic blueprints, that's all it is. But when a woman builds a child, she does all the work, she does everything. The entire body of the child comes from the woman. Is that right? She builds its physical reality and it takes time and space and takes pain. Why there is time and space and pain in the female dimension is because you're moving away from the spiritual world. In order to give birth to something in the physical, you have to make it finite. Is that clear? Whereas in the spiritual world, the thing is infinite. Let's give an example that's not so difficult maybe. When an architect wants to build a building, the maleness is the flesh of the idea. Then he starts to make it more and more female as he starts to define its details. Then the builders start to build it, and the ultimate female level is when the building's completed. It corresponds exactly to what it was in his mind. Exactly, but this in the physical reality. In the mind, it was infinite, it took less than a second, it was experience of happiness, and it was in totality. But the building is slow and painful and it's finite, and when it's built, it's only one building. When it was potent in his mind, it could have been anything. When it's finally frozen into reality, it's just one thing. Okay? The mystics say that when a child is formed, when the seed is laid, when the seed, what the husband contributes, the moment of conception, is an incredible moment because it could be expressed in any way. But when a woman forms the child, it's just this one person. Of course, the happiness and beauty that a woman understands is that it's now real, can do something in the world, and build its own spiritual reality. But the sadness of it is that it's not spiritual anymore. It's not potent anymore, it's just one thing. You have to understand this. That's the deep secret of why the word for a woman is the same as the word for curse. You have to understand that. The word nekeva in Hebrew, right, means a noikev shem Hashem, means to curse, to what we call bless Hashem's name, but it means the opposite, right? Why? Because the idea of that kind of curse means, instead of letting a thing be spiritual, it means limiting a thing to just one thing. That's what a woman does. Which is fantastic brocha. That's why the woman's, the symbol of a woman in the world is brocha, because she brings forth. But also the opposite is in her hands. Understand carefully. By the way, if you want to understand this in a more emotional way, you see it often happens in relationships. What happens is a man wants to feel a bit of freedom. He needs to express himself. Often in marriages you see this problem. The man wants to express a bit of freedom. What happens, a woman gets anxious when a man starts behaving that way, and she tries to hold and squeeze in and limit. The more she limits him, the more he feels a terrible need to break out. Is that right? And the more she starts to panic and clamp in. Is that right? That's right. Many problems in marriage arise that way. The trick of being a woman is to allow a man to express his freedom, because that's what a man is. A man is always needing a new experience. That's what he is spiritually. As we've commented here many times before, right? That's why the mystics say a man never grows up. Men never grow up. Because they always need to be experimenting, and yeah, that's what they say. A woman is a woman, but a man is a child always. That's what it says. That's why, as we've said many times before, you'll see that men of 50 are playing with the same toys that they played with when they were 15. It's just more expensive versions maybe, but the same thing. Men always need a new experience. It's also why men have ordeals with other women. A married man always has an ordeal with other women. Whereas a kosher Jewish woman never has an ordeal of being attracted physically in a serious way. Because that's not where a woman is. What she wants to do is deepen and consolidate and make more beautiful the relationship. Whereas a man always needs to feel he has a new experience. That's the same spiritual idea that we're talking about now. So what we have is this, that the dimension of being female is the dimension that makes the thing real, makes it solid, makes it finite. And that's the circle. Because a circle is the only shape known to man of all geometrical shapes. It's the only shape where the smallest segment of the shape determines the whole shape. If you take the smallest segment of a circle and you continue it with the same parameters that it started with, you'll definitely end up where you began and you'll keep going round. There's no other shape that does that. A straight line, you don't know where it will end. Any irregular shape, you don't know where the next bend will be. But a circle, if you take its defining characteristics for the smallest segment and you just carry on, you'll have a circle, which is a symbol of no change. It doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, and it always goes the same. It's the greatest limitation in the world, while being the greatest perfection, but also the symbol of no newness. There's no spark of newness. It's purely female. A circle doesn't have any beginning. There's no male input. Are you with me? And that's why the most fantastic thing is the Midrash says that the whole chapter of Genesis doesn't have a single samach. You know, the Hebrew letter samach is a circle. The letter samach, which is the letter of evil in the world, it's the defining letter of evil. Perfect circle. There is no samach in the whole chapter of Genesis. You know that? Because it's all newness. It's all a flash of new creation, so it never can have the symbol of a thing that's only continuation. There's one exception, and the Midrash talks about it. The first time you have a samach in the Chumash is Vayizkor Basar Tachtena, that Hashem, when He created woman. The creation of woman is the first time you find a circle in the Torah. You're not going to come next week, right? Right? Because when a woman came into the world, she was able to take the flashes of... To know the beauty of it is to be able to freeze into reality and maintain life. That's what it is. When a woman makes a child, she doesn't take a seed from a man and freeze it. She keeps it alive as a flame. And she builds and builds and builds. And when it needs to, she lets it tear away from herself, even though it's very painful. And later, emotionally, she has to do the same thing again. When children get older, she has to do the same thing again. But the skill of being a woman is knowing how much input, how much to put in terms of crystallizing the thing into reality without freezing it permanently at any one moment without killing it. That's the skill of being a woman. A woman who knows how to live that way at the intimate details we have to talk about some other time, but a woman who knows how to function that way allows a man a sense of newness always. So he never has to look elsewhere. The secret of a marriage is the ability to be able to concretize and bring down to earth and make real everything that her husband is, and yet allow him to be a powerhouse of generation all the time. Let's understand that. The nidah laws, the mikvah laws, are the core of how you achieve this in marriage. It's another subject. Now, there's one other parsha in the Torah. If you look through the whole Chumash, you'll find there's one other parsha where the whole parsha doesn't have a samach. You know that? Where is that? The parsha of Bechor, the firstborn of animals. The laws regarding what you do with the firstborn of animals, there's no samach in the whole parsha. Why? Because it's firstborn again. It's first birth. We follow what the Torah is trying to say over here. Is that when you come onto the moment of creation, so then the last thing, you don't have the sign, the symbol of continuity. All you have is the symbols of generation, but you don't have, are you with me? Now, let's put this together and try and understand. So if you want to live spiritually, you want to live as a Jew, you have to live at the crest of a wave that's always breaking. That means you have to be generating something new. If you ever let it freeze, if you ever let it be just what it was yesterday, so that's called death. The mystics say that if you're alive today because you were alive yesterday, that's called dying. That's just called disintegrating. It's rolling on from the moment of birth, just rolling on to the end. Right? Anything you do because you were doing it before, that's not called being alive. Everything you do has to be alive, has to be done because you just gave birth to it now. You have to consciously give birth to everything right now. At least every day. We've discussed this before. A great person does it all the time, literally. But at least every day you have to be new. At least every day you have to be what you are today because you just gave birth to yourself. We learn this, obviously, from Avraham Avinu, from Abraham. Because he was the spark of newness. He was a man who took himself from a family of idolaters, and we say this on Pesach. He took himself from a family that was steeped in idolatry, right, which is nothing new. And he flashed himself into a new being. He suddenly realized where the spiritual core was, and he became that. And what was his famous statement? Anuichi ofar va'ether. I am dust and ashes. So you know what the Bala Musar explained? What does it mean when a person says he's dust and ashes? What he meant was this remarkable idea. That I take everything that I am at any instant of my life and I burn it to ash. Ash is just the remnants. It's just the elemental components of what was constructed before, completely unconstructed, down to its bare elements. And then out of that, I make afar, dust, dust of the earth. The earth which gives birth to new life. That means at every moment of his life, he was ashing his past and only using the barest elements to reconstruct his life again. That means he never did anything because he'd done it before. Every flicker of an eyelid of his was a completely new experience that he consciously gave birth to. But it's difficult to live on that level, but at least once a day, the Bala Musa say, a person should sit on his bed at night, or her bed, and before he goes to sleep, you should say to yourself, what did I achieve today? Be critically honest about it. Give yourself tremendous pat on the back and simcha for what you did that was great. And tell yourself honestly where you failed. And make a fantastic resolution that tomorrow you're going to achieve something new that you didn't do today. And wake up tomorrow inspired about it in order to do that. With a flash of new energy. But otherwise you're not being Jewish. Otherwise you're just rolling on. You can't afford to do that. And the older you get, the worse it gets. Because the more the habit sets in. You can't afford habit. That's what new birth has to be. That's what a Jewish life has to be. And we're able to do it because we were born that way. Our moment of conception was a moment that beat time. That's what it has to be. You see that this idea runs the Jewish thinking. I'll give you one fascinating example. You know, in Judaism, in Torah, when you express the transition from the past to the present to the future, so you see that the words express this most amazingly. I'll give you one example. The word, when you say to somebody in Hebrew, from where do you come? Where do you come from? And where are you going to? Where do you come from? Who are you? And where are you going to? All those words have the same root. Do you know that? Me'ayin, right? Me'ayin tavo, me'ayin bata, from where do you come? The word ani, that means who I am. And la'an telech, ana telech, where are you going to? They're all the same aleph nun root in Hebrew. Which means this, that when you say to somebody, where do you come from? The sense of who he is now and where he's going to, they're all the same rearrangements of the same letters, Aleph Nun, Aleph Nun Yud, the letters for I. That word, Ani, also means Hashem. It's a remarkable thing in the mystical writings, that the word that means me also means the name of Hashem. But now listen to this. When you say to somebody in English, where do you come from, the words mean where do you come from. That's all it means. And where are you going to, the words mean where you're going to. Nothing else in those words. But in Hebrew, listen to what you say. You say, me'ayin bata, where do you come? You know what the word literally means? You come from nothingness. Ayin in Hebrew means ain, it means is not. So when you say to somebody, where do you come from, the what you're actually expressing to him, we don't hear this anymore, those people who speak Hebrew, because you're born speaking it, so you don't hear the depth of it. But what the words mean is, this, where do you come from? You come from nothingness. And where are you going to? You know what the word ana means in Hebrew? Ana means, there's no word for it in English, it's an expression of the most intense, indescribable longing for a new reality. Like we say, ana Hashem Oshiana, please Hashem, bring us to the new, to a new level of spiritual existence. Anna. Please in English, but it's not, it's much deeper than that. So now, listen to Hebrew. Listen to what kind of a language this is, that this people that we are. This is the way we speak. Somebody walks in, I mean, it couldn't be more mundane. He walks in from the garden and he's going off to the kitchen. And you want to ask him, where did you come from? Where are you going to? Nothing more spiritual than that. What do the words mean? You come from nothingness, and you are going to an expression of indescribable longing that will bear proportion to what you are now, like what now is to nothingness. You understand that? You came from nothingness, and you are. What you are as an ani is an explosion of being as a human being that just translated itself out of the word nothingness. That means what happened to you when you walked in from there to here, you transitioned from being an ain, which means an is not, to being what I am. And where you're going from here to the next moment of your life is in proportion as great as that. What kind of a people speaks that way? A spiritual people. In other words, what you're expressing in Hebrew is that the most mundane moment of life is a transition from nothing to something, and it's exploding from there into something that you can't even give a word to. It's amazing. That's how the Jewish people live. There's no other way to say it in Hebrew. Not even modern Israeli Hebrew. There's no other way to say it. Because that's what the words literally mean. That's what Abraham did. That's what Abraham did. He managed to generate himself. The mystics put it this way. They say it. And if you read in Genesis, it says, Eile toldois ha-shamayim ba'aretz behi baram. These are the generations of the creation of the heavens and the earth in their being created. What's in their being created? Behi baram, if you rearrange the letters, it spells ba'avraham. That means these are the generations of the creation of the heaven and the earth in Abraham. That means he was such a potent man that the heavens and earth, creation of the whole of reality, is considered to be part of him. That means he brought that into existence. Because he was able to reform who he is. That's how he's supposed to live. That's what you're supposed to be. Now, where do you see it in Pesach? So now it's easy to understand. After this discussion, if you're with me, you'll understand very easily. We had to be born in a moment that was beyond time. We couldn't afford, Hashem couldn't afford to take us out slowly. If our going out expanded into a palpable time, then we would have been human. We would have been less than, we would have been finite. We would have been expanded into the circle. He had to take us out before the shape even got defined. And if you think about it, isn't that what runs through the whole of Pesach? Example. What's the main mitzvah of Pesach? Matzah. You know what the difference is between matzah and chometz? Time. So, think that's an accident? You know what matzah is? Matzah is flour and water that's mixed and baked within 18 minutes. 18 minutes is always the time of life. 18 is always the moment of life, conception. If you mix flour and water and you bake it, it's an amazing thing. It's worth going to Jerusalem. It's worth going to Shalom just to walk through the old city and go into the matzah bakeries. Going to the old bakeries, also Nach Yeshiva, if you have the merit to be there. So every year, we take over a bakery and you go in there, all the boys in the Yeshiva, and they have a conveyor belt system where everybody does with a stopwatch. And it gets into the fire within 18 minutes from being mixed and kneaded and rolled. It's an amazing experience. Right? What happens? If it's baked and the fermentation process is stopped before it's begun, you have matzah. What's the result of eating matzah? It's a mitzvah esei d'oraisa. It's a mitzvah that takes you into the highest spiritual realms. It connects you with the moment of birth. If the water is mixed with the flour for 1 second too long, if it's baked 1 second after 18 minutes, you know what it's called? Chometz. You know what chometz is? Spiritual death. If you eat chometz on Pesach, even a crumb, of course it's a crumb. It's got nothing to do with expanding. Exactly, it has to be that. That's why it's a mitzvah, unlike others, where you have to eat a certain amount of it. Pesach, we're not interested in expanding into amounts. You follow? The whole concept of Pesach is the instant of birth. One crumb's enough. One crumb of yeast ferments everything. You follow? We can't afford to wait till it expands. That's exactly the opposite of what Pesach is. So one crumb, and one crumb of what? Of chometz. Chometz is exactly the same as matzah. It's not like pork and beef. They're two different realities. Chometz and Mat, exactly the same thing, only different, 2 seconds. Right? The only difference is that you left it 1 second long. You just let it expand into the physical dimension. And the punishment is spiritual death. The reward for mitzvah is spiritual life. The punishment for chometz, just a difference of seconds, is spiritual death. That's exactly what it is. If your life is predicated on the moment of birth, you're alive. If it expands into physicality, you just died. Might take less, might take more, but you just died. You know what they point out? If you write the word matzah in Hebrew, and you write the word chometz, do you know that it's the same letters? Do you know that? Chometz and matzah, the only difference is that matzah has a hay, and chometz has a ches. That's the only difference. You know what the difference is between a ches and a hay in Hebrew? The tiniest drop of ink. Do you know that? Because a hay is like that, and it doesn't touch. A ches touches. If it doesn't touch, it's a hay. If it touches, it's a ches. That's all. That's the difference between chometz and matzah. That's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. That's why they had to go out before the dough rose. They had to go out of Egypt while the matzah was still matzah. We had to be formed as a people before chometz, before expansion took place. You know what chometz is? It's when the dough starts to expand. It's when it's unreal. Matzah is what you see is what you get. It's flour and water and it's baked like that. Chometz is where it starts to get expanded with unreality. It's the expansion of pride in the personality. It's the expansion of all the unreal qualities. You follow? It looks much bigger than it is. It just swells up out of proportion. That's what it is. It expands into the physical world. All these ideas are not accidental. That's what it is. And therefore, we had to be born at a time. We had to be born beyond time. And you'll see this idea in many, many ways. That's the concept of rushing out of Egypt in that moment of creation. That's the idea of chometz and matzah. I think, I haven't heard this from a reliable source, so you have only my idea, but I think it's correct, is that you see that when the plagues happened in Egypt, there's a fascinating story. You know that when the plagues happened, Pharaoh, Paro, called to his advisors, his sorcerers, to do the same thing. You know that when the water turned to blood, he got his people to do the same thing. It was no problem for them. You know that. When the sticks were thrown down and became snakes, his people could do that also. In other words, they could reproduce, they could duplicate all the magical, all the mysterious, mystical elements of the plague. There's one that they couldn't. One plague that Hashem brought on Egypt, that they tried as they might, they couldn't reproduce. What was it? Lice. Kinim, lice. When the Egyptians were smitten with lice, the sorcerers couldn't reproduce that. You know why? Because it says they were too small. Kinim, lice are very small creatures. They're less than what's called an adasha, a barley grain. And it says in Anocha that impurity, spiritual death impurity, can only attach itself to something that's bigger than a barley grain. Right? An adasha. Etzim kadasha, etzim kasoira, I think, a barley grain. But if it's smaller than that, impurity can't attach itself to it. And since their power was a power of impurity, they were using the black forces to produce their magic. So therefore their forces which were in the black world, they couldn't take effect on something too small. Why? Again, when you shrink small enough, when you come close to the source of creation, when you shrink time, when you shrink space, you approach the world of purity. You hear that idea? And therefore, that's the story of Pesach. What it means for us is this. I said that if you understand this idea, we'll understand a key to our own existence. And that key is this. You have to live your life at the point of new creation. You can't afford ever to become stale, not even for a moment. Certainly not for a day. You have to be flashing. You know what it says in the Baalei Musa? Most remarkable example. It says that the only way to beat the Yetzer Hara, you know, the yeast inside of you that expands your own being out of proportion, is your own negativity. It's called the yeast. It's called your own Yetzer, So'o Shebe'isa. It's your own expanded sense of self, your own ego. You know how you beat that? Do you know what it says in the Baalei Musa? How you beat your own negativity? You move fast. It's easy to say this, not easy to do. If you move fast enough, he can't catch up with you. Why? Because your inner core, listen to this, Neshama Shenasata Bi Tehorehi, the soul that you gave inside me is always pure. The inner purity is always beyond time and space. But the dimension of negativity is always in time and space. What makes you want to do things that are negative are always that which has a physical allure. It's always in time, it's always in space. Think about it, I'll give you an example. What does the Yetzer always tell you to do? What does your negative drive always tell you to do? What you did yesterday. He never comes up with anything new. Is that right? He just dresses it up, sometimes in a little bit of a new colors. Isn't it embarrassing? You fell for it yesterday, and you fell for it the day before, and you fell for it so many times, and he manages to get you to do the same thing. Does he ever come up with a new idea? Does he ever inspire you to generate something new? Definitely. Not interested in that. He wants to keep you in the rut. He wants to train you into habit. Do it again. Do it again. Do it again. That's why the Balei Musa say, you know what the first, let's understand the beauty of Jewish, understand the beauty of Judaism. Give you an example. Where would you expect if I gave you the body of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch? We'll finish with this idea. If I gave you the code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, and I asked you, where would you expect in the code of Jewish law, in which section of the code of Jewish law would you expect to find this concept? What would you say? What's taking you so long? The beginning, obviously. That's what you meant, right? The beginning. The first halacha. The first halacha, obviously. That's what's the first law in the code of Jewish law? When you wake up in the morning, get out of bed. That's what it says. Yisgaber ka'ari lakum baboker. For some of us, this is harder to speak about than others. But it says, when you awaken in the morning, you must leap out of bed like a lion. Awake like a lion in the morning to serve Hashem. You should get up before the dawn, it says, and so forth. Now, why? Why? Because the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch is the beginning of your own creation. And the way you begin yourself is by getting up fast. When you arise from unconsciousness into consciousness, if you allow that moment to expand, so the rest of your day will be expanded. If the moment of awareness, of consciousness, if you become aware, if you transition from unconsciousness into consciousness, and it expands into time, so then your whole day is going to expand into the resistance, of the physicality. And therefore, if you want a crude application, the way the Balei Musa put it is this. The way you should do it is this. As you become conscious in the morning, leap out of bed. Why? Because if you wait just 1 second, he starts speaking to you. He says, you know, now 1 second, don't panic. That's what he says to you. Right? This is the way the Yetzer speaks to you. He says, listen, don't do anything rash. Just think about things for a second. He says, never mind what you heard last night at this shiur. He says, it's nice and warm here in bed, right? You say, right. Then he says, then there's lots of good reasons for staying here. And he starts to give you that, all the reasons why another hour of sleep would actually benefit you tremendously, and it's necessary for your health. And so forth and so on. Once he's got a hold of you, it's too late. Once he's speaking to you, you've had it. Once he's got you, I promise you, if you leap out of bed and then have a debate with yourself, it's hard enough. But if he speaks to you while he's got you there and he holds you down for just a minute, it's too late already. Right? Everything's on his side. Therefore, the only way you can beat him, the only way you can beat him is you must move faster than he does, which is what your ability is. He can never move as fast as your spiritual call. He can never move into that moment of conception. And that's why it says, in the moment of conception, there's never anything wrong. Right? Sin, the concept of doing something wrong, never happens in the moment of a new conception. You never flash into a new idea and something gone wrong over there. Only once it's with you, then the physicality has the time to start expanding it into things. There's many examples. It says in the mystical system that what are forbidden for a man is thoughts of sin. That men have this problem particularly. What's called hirhurei avera, thoughts of sin. Fantasies, thoughts of sin. But what's interesting is that the word that's used for thoughts is hirhurim. The normal word for thoughts in Hebrew is machshava. Why doesn't it use the word machshava? Because in the mystical system, a machshava is a thought that is the first thought that arrives in the mind, but it doesn't yet have any expansion into details. Hirur is when it expands itself into physical details. That's what bothers you. That's what bothers a person. The idea doesn't bother anybody. No man is bothered by the flesh of an idea. That doesn't prove any problem for him. What proves the problem is when it starts to flesh itself out into details and starts to take on shape and form. That's already the level of hirur. That is where your problems arise. And you'll see this idea in many, many ways in the spiritual world. You have to function at the moment of creation. You have to function at the moment of rotzen. You have to put your rotzen into action. You have to always generate yourself as somebody new. And that is, I think, one of the essential ingredients of Pesach. We should take this idea, Mitzvah Shem and Bizoicha, that we should be able to at least live every day like that. That no day, whenever you feel yourself drag, whenever you feel anything is something you've been through before, or anything becomes a drag, or anything becomes painful in life, so you have to be aware that your obligation is to generate a new consciousness out of this idea. That this day that you're dragging through now, this negative experience, or whatever it is, you have to ask yourself, where's the newness in this? Right? And if you flash onto newness, you'll find untapped, untold sources of energy. And those sources of energy could make you be what you're supposed to be. And that's what we experience at Pesach. That's why it's springtime, when everything begins to grow. Purim was in the darkness in the winter, in the northern hemisphere. Pesach is the springtime, when everything bursts out in open miracles. And that's why, if you latch onto that way, the wave of new creation, the moment of conception, so then you can be completely unlimited. You can leap to levels that are impossible. You can have problems in your human relationships, in your family, in your physical, you can have problems in all areas. Pesach is a time you can leap with inspiration to a level that's impossible. That's only gift that you're given. Pesach time, you could leap up there. Pesach means diluk, it means leaping beyond your level. That's exactly what it is. You could leap up there and you could hold on there.